tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
President Obama says the U.S. fears future Russian encroachment into Ukraine, and Chinese families of the missing Malaysian jet protest. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama says the United States is concerned about the possibility of Russia moving farther into Ukraine after its annexation of Crimea. Speaking today at a joint news conference with the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte in The Hague, Mr. Obama said Washington is concerned about further encroachment by Russia into Ukraine, but added that it would be a bad choice on Russia's part and that the U.S. and European allies have plans for further sanctions on Russia if necessary.
We have said, and I want to be very clear about this, we're not recognizing what has happened in Crimea. The notion that a referendum sloppily organized over the course of 2 weeks would somehow justify the breaking off of Crimea and the annexation by Russia. That somehow that would be a valid process, I think the overwhelming majority of the world rejects.
Meanwhile, earlier today, Russia dismissed as counterproductive a move by world powers to cut Moscow out of the group of eight industrialized nations over its actions in Ukraine. You heard more details on the president's comments at voanews.com. Mr. Obama is also calling for an end to the National Security Agency's massive collection and storage of data about Americans' phone calls. Under a plan unveiled today, the government would have to obtain permission from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to obtain data from phone companies on calls connected to suspected terrorists. The phone companies would not be required to maintain the phone call records for any longer than they do now. This is President Obama.
They have presented me now with an option that I think is workable, and it addresses the two core concerns that people had. Number one, the idea of government storing bulk data generally. This ensures that the government is not in possession of that bulk data.
President Obama made those comments at a news conference in the Netherlands. Mr. Obama launched a review of the NSA's phone surveillance program after the former national security contractor Edward Snowden last year leaked thousands of documents. Angry relatives of the passengers on board the missing Malaysian jetliner protested in front of the Malaysian embassy in Beijing today as a search for the plane was suspended due to bad weather. Around 100 Chinese members held signs and demanded to know the truth about the plane, which Malaysian authorities have now concluded crashed into a remote area of the southern Indian Ocean. Proof of the plane's whereabouts is not likely to come soon as Australian authorities were forced to delay the search for 24 hours because of high waves and strong winds, as well as dense clouds. This is Australia's Defence Minister, David Johnston.
Look, I'm not surprised about anything with respect to this. This is a mystery, and until we recover and positively identify a piece of debris, everything is virtually speculation.
You could read more details as this story develops at voanews.com. 35 countries have pledged to turn international nuclear security guidelines into national laws, signing on to the initiative at a nuclear summit in The Hague, Netherlands. The initiative requires participating nations to open their security procedures to independent review. Delegations from 53 countries are participating in the two-day Hague summit. The prosecution has rested in the murder trial of South African athlete Oscar Pistorius. An attorney for Pistorius says the Olympic runner is expected to testify after the defense begins its case on Friday. Pistorius has pleaded not guilty to charges that he intentionally murdered his girlfriend, model Reva Steenkamp. Today, Pistorius's lawyer tried to show that he had a loving relationship with Steenkamp. The attorney re-examined a police cell phone expert and had the officer read out affectionate texts and phone messages between the couple. The leader of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood and nearly 700 members of the group went on trial today on charges including murder and inciting violence. A lawyer said after just a few hours that the trial of Mohamed Badi and the others was adjourned until April 28th when a judgment and sentencing is expected. You can read more details on that and more at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization says at least 59 people have died following an outbreak of the Ebola virus in Guinea. Health officials are taking steps to contain the outbreak, including educating the public about ways to keep the virus from spreading.
That's Jennifer Lazuta reporting from our West Africa Bureau in Dakar. We'll have the latest developments on this story coming up. Also, a new report says the Ethiopian government is using some of the world's most advanced surveillance software to monitor communications from Ethiopians at home and abroad. Wheat farmers in Ethiopia are on alert for a dangerous outbreak of stem rust. And a Harvard professor says developing countries were forced down an economic path in the 20th century that led to stunted development. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our feature reports. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the World Health Organization says at least 59 people have died following an outbreak of the Ebola virus in Guinea. Health officials are taking steps to contain the outbreak, including educating the public about ways to keep the virus from spreading. Jennifer Lazuta has more from our West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
Guinea's Ministry of Health says there have been at least 86 suspected cases of Ebola hemorrhagic fever in the country's southeastern forest region since February 9th. Liberia's Ministry of Health says five people who crossed the border from affected areas in Guinea into Lofa County for treatment also died from Ebola. Health officials are also investigating suspected cases in Sierra Leone. Plan International is a nonprofit that promotes children's development. The group's regional director of disaster risk management, Roland Berehadougou, is in Conakry to work on containment efforts.
People are scared, they're rightly scared, but so far we are not seeing a mass movement of people leaving the area. And the key thing we are seeing there is a lack of information. So now we are supporting the government, the Minister of Health, for providing mass communication using the radio, the TV, local radios, providing also SMS to inform people about the situation and the prevention measures they should take to protect themselves against the disease.
Berehadougou says schools are of particular concern because children come into such close contact with one another. The World Health Organization says Ebola is one of the most contagious viral diseases. It is spread through contact with bodily fluids, such as sweat, blood, and saliva, of an infected person or animal. There is no vaccine or cure. Symptoms usually start with a fever, headache, vomiting, and diarrhea. Some people experience bleeding through the eyes, ears, nose, or mouth. The most recent outbreaks occurred in Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2012. 57 people died. In 2007, Ebola killed 187 people during an outbreak in the DRC. The director of WHO's Disease Prevention and Control Unit in Africa, Dr. Francis Kasalo, worked on such outbreaks.
What we did was working with the health facilities, we instituted a strong, what we call infection prevention procedures, which included proper disposal of materials that may be soiled with bodily fluids, proper disposal of the corpse or the bodies that are professors that have died from potentially suspected Ebola cases.
He said the length of time to contain an outbreak can vary, but the sooner you start, the better. This is the first human Ebola outbreak in Guinea and in West Africa, Kasalo said. This made it harder to identify the virus as Ebola. Ebola causes viral hemorrhagic fever, but so do several other illnesses common to the region, including Lassa fever. He said health workers in Guinea just are not as familiar with the disease.
Our own thinking is that the alert levels amongst the health workers and the community is not as high as, for instance, in Uganda and DRC, where Ebola occurs mostly every second or third year. So it's a question of people reporting a suspicious or unusual illness, but because they're not familiar with that, it does take a little while for them to finally think of Ebola.
Aid organizations are now supplying protective gear to health workers, as well as other medical supplies and medications to ease the symptoms of infected people. Doctors Without Borders has set up isolation units in southern Guinea to treat suspected cases. The ministries of health in Guinea and Liberia say public information campaigns are underway to educate people about the symptoms of Ebola and the modes of transmission. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
An Egyptian court has opened the trial of nearly 700 Muslim Brotherhood members, including the group's top leader. The trial today in Minya comes a day after the court sentenced 529 Brotherhood members to death on charges that include the murder of a police officer, attacking a police station, and other acts of violence. The first trial took just 2 days, drawing international criticism over whether the proceedings were fair. Sabah Mahmoud, associate professor of anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley, told VOA today that there was no due process in Egypt and called the sentencing ridiculous. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf said the United States was deeply concerned and pretty shocked after yesterday's decision. Eleven minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new report from Human Rights Watch says the Ethiopian government is using some of the world's most advanced surveillance software to monitor communications from Ethiopians at home and abroad. Marta van der Werf reports from Addis Ababa.
Human Rights Watch says that the Ethiopian government is spying on its citizens and monitoring the activities of Ethiopians in the diaspora by using high-tech software from China, Italy, and Germany. Felix Horn is the Horn of Africa researcher with the International Human Rights Organization. He says the Ethiopian government has unlimited access to records of phone calls and emails of Ethiopians at home and abroad.
Inside of Ethiopia, its control of its Chinese-developed telecom system results in it having unfettered access to the phone records, to the metadata of all phone calls in the country. Outside of the country, they're using Western-made technologies to target the activities of very specific members of the diaspora. These technologies are being provided by a company in Italy called Hacking Team and a company in Germany called Gamma.
Ethiopia's telecommunication is monopolized by the state-owned Ethio Telecom. A SIM card can only be obtained in Ethiopia after registering personal details, making it easy for the government to identify domestic callers, according to Human Rights Watch. A U.S. citizen of Ethiopian origin filed a lawsuit against the Ethiopian government last month, saying his computer had been hacked and he had been spied on for more than 4 months. Horn says that certain ethnic groups feel particularly at risk when answering phone calls from abroad.
One of the things that we found in our research is that individuals that receive phone calls from abroad are often targeted and accused of talking to banned organizations or of plotting something against government, despite there being very little evidence to that effect.
Getachew Reda, an advisor to Ethiopia's prime minister, denies the Human Rights Watch report. He says the group has made it a habit to accuse Ethiopia of almost everything that goes wrong in the region, and it has a negative knee-jerk reaction about any developments in the country. He adds that the government would not waste resources in eavesdropping conversation of opposition figures and that the accusations are pure hogwash. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
A summit on wheat for food security gets underway today in Obregon, Mexico. A major topic of discussion will be a stem rust outbreak that occurred last year in Ethiopia, the largest producer of wheat in sub-Saharan Africa. Stem rust is a plant disease that comes with different strains, and as wheat yields soar in Ethiopia, wheat farmers are on alert after the 2013 outbreak decimated more than 10,000 hectares of wheat in the southern part of the country. Kaylee Abeyo is a senior scientist with the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center and is based in Ethiopia. He spoke with me from the summit in Mexico.
Bale is the wheat belt of Ethiopia. Bale has 2 growing seasons for wheat. Recently, we had surveys during the belg season, which is a short rainy season and the main rainy season. We did the survey. At that time, no incidence was observed, but in early October, we started to observe high incidence on popular variety Digaloo. Then in short time, it wiped out this variety planted over 10,000 hectares by small-scale farmers.
What exactly is stem rust, and why are there so many different strains of it?
There are three types of rust normally devastating wheat production across the globe. One is yellow rust, the second one is stem rust, and the third one is leaf rust. Stem rust affects mainly the stem as well as the sheaths and awns. So all nutrients the plant absorbs from the ground should move through the stem to fill the grain. But this stem rust is affecting the stem as well as the leaves. So the translocation of nutrients from the soil to the grain is limited. And as a result, the devastation might go up to 100% yield loss. Ethiopia is a hot spot for rust breeding. The current epidemic of rust occurred in 2010. Yellow rust devastated wide area of wheat grown by small-scale farmers. In 2013, we're expecting that yellow rust might come, and there was a fear of that. So that is why we did the survey. But during the survey, we have very low incidence of yellow rust and stem rust. But shortly, in early November, we had high level of stem rust on popular variety Digaloo. The outbreak fast and devastated a large area in short time.
What is your goal at the summit this week in Mexico in trying to curb this strain of stem rust?
This is a teamwork not handled by Ethiopia, and as a global rust initiative, it has to be tackled through different means, through breeding, by developing durably resistant varieties.
How bad was it in Ethiopia with this latest outbreak of stem rust? How did it affect the wheat production?
In Bale, three districts, and in RC, three districts, in total, six districts covering about 20 to 40,000 hectares was highly infected by the disease. Some farmers have spread because of the early warning system we have given advice, but some who didn't get the right fungicide, they got a total devastation, 100% yield loss.
So what does that mean for wheat for this year, for 2014?
Let me say this. In 2013, though we had this outbreak, still the country has the highest harvest ever of wheat because this was a localized epidemic and we have limited the effect and the devastation and the distribution because of the early warning system. Farmers are aware of, the government is aware of having reserve fungicides, and all researchers have educated extension agents, so everyone was aware of, so it was minimized. When production is boosted, then the effect of the outbreak was limited to a few districts.
That was Bekele Abeyo, a senior scientist with the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center. He spoke with me from Obregon, Mexico. Nineteen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A Harvard professor says developing countries were forced down an economic path in the 20th century that lacked innovation, entrepreneurship, and technology. As a result, he says, they had stunted development while many other nations prospered. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Professor Calistus Juma tells the story of dueling economic theories, one based on new ideas and risk-taking, and the other on pessimism and ignorance. It's the story of the haves and the have-nots. Juma is professor of the practice of international development and faculty chair of the Innovation for Economic Development Executive Program.
In 1900,
2011, an Austrian economist by the name of Joseph Schumpeter published a book called The Theory of Economic Development, which proposed that economies grow over time through innovation, through new combinations that involved the application of new technologies. And this book became really a standard on how to think about economic transformation through the use of technology and entrepreneurship.
Juma says Schumpeter took a different view on what was needed for robust economic growth.
It was new because up to that point, people believed that economies grew because of extraction of natural resources, not because of application of technologies. It was also new because he proposed that the use of new technologies resulted in revolutionary changes in economic systems.
Schumpeter, he says, based his theory on what he saw happening in developed nations.
He made the observation by looking at the impact of railroads in Europe and America. So rich nations were already doing it, but it had not been explained in a clear and explicit way, which had to do with this idea of introducing new combinations in the economy, which is technological combinations, but also the recognition that these new technological transformations were being driven by entrepreneurs. So entrepreneurship became a very central part of his thinking.
Professor Juma says new industries develop through what's called creative destruction.
His idea was that when you introduce, say, railroads in a community which didn't have railroads before, so they're using stagecoaches. Railroads will destroy stagecoaches. That industry will disappear. But it will create a new industry, which is a faster industry with a greater opportunity for economic expansion. If you think of it in modern times, if we introduce downloading of music, it destroys CDs. So it's destructive to the CDs, but it creates new industries, which is downloading of music.
Such developments are common today, but many economists in the 20th century thought the developing world was not ready for Schumpeter's ideas.
So the critics said emerging economies don't have new technologies. Secondly, he said the agent of change is the entrepreneur. Then they argued that the entrepreneur is not the biggest player in poor economies. You need big government, you need bureaucracies. And thirdly, he put a lot of emphasis on industrial production. His critics said what the poor want is not production, they want consumption. So we give them some products that have been developed elsewhere, but it doesn't make sense to enable them to produce themselves.
Juma does not think racism was behind their beliefs, but rather pessimism about developing countries.
Because they looked at them and said, they are so poor, we cannot possibly give them the latest technologies because they are not even able to absorb them. So let's find them older technologies. So I don't think it was racism. I think it was a mindset that was more colored by pessimism and less by an appreciation that even poor countries are able to solve their own problems when given a chance.
Instead, they were given so-called appropriate technologies. Juma says instead of a modern water supply with sewers, they were told to dig wells. Instead of building modern electric grids, they were given fuel-efficient stoves. During the HIV/AIDS epidemic, many doubted African nations had the capability to distribute and administer antiretroviral drugs. And as a result, they said, the drugs could not be effective. African nations proved them wrong.
Again, that was another example of pessimism, of saying there's really very little you can do for these countries because they don't have the infrastructure. The same infrastructure they had been denied from building in the first place.
In the 20th century, many had thought Ghana had the potential to become an economic powerhouse, that it would become what South Korea is today.
It's very interesting you bring up the case of Ghana because Ghana at independence got a foreign economic advisor, a Nobel laureate in economics, Arthur Lewis. He was one of the critics of Schumpeter, who did not believe that a country like Ghana was capable of transforming itself technologically, whereas South Korea was able to do that. At that time, there wasn't a big difference between South Korea and Ghana.
Juma recommends giving priority to innovation, technical and engineering fields, transformative infrastructure, and entrepreneurship. The Harvard professor is working on a new book containing his ideas. it has the tentative title of How Economies Succeed, Innovation and the Wealth of Nations. It's due out in 2015. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The World Health Organization reports air pollution is now the world's largest single environmental health risk. A new report finds 7 million people died from exposure to air pollution in 2012, more than double the number previously estimated in 2008. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Air pollution is a global problem. The World Health Organization reports 1 in 8 people around the world die from air pollution. It says new data show people exposed to indoor and outdoor air pollution die prematurely from cardiovascular diseases such as strokes and ischemic heart disease, as well as chronic pulmonary diseases and cancer. The World Health Organization reports most deaths from air pollution occur in low- and middle-income countries in Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific, where about half the world's population cook and heat their homes using open fires and simple stoves. Health officials say the use of coal and biomass fuels, such as wood, animal dung, and crop waste, is responsible for 4.2 million people dying prematurely in 2012. They link an additional 3.7 million deaths in urban and rural areas to outdoor air pollution. WHO Public Health, Environmental and Social Determinants of Health Coordinator Carlos Dora says clean air cannot be bought in a bottle.
To resolve this issue, it's quite important that countries, nations take action, which is more or less coordinated. And the reason for that is that the airshed small particles travel thousands of kilometers, normally around the hemisphere traveling east. So pollution in one country will affect a number of other countries downwind.
Dr. Dora says air pollution used to be worse in developed than in developing countries, but he says developed countries, notably the United Kingdom and United States, have taken action which has dramatically reduced air pollution during the past decade.
We know that those interventions work on energy, especially on transportation, better engines, cleaner fuels, more efficient energy technologies, reduction in the need for you for the use of energy, insulation of houses, etc., clean energy, solar, wind, energy that doesn't use combustion is better than those that do use combustion.
Dr. Dora says in most cases, healthier air pollution strategies will be more economical in the long run because healthcare costs will go down. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
African music.
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000, and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The World Health Organization says at least 59 people have died following an outbreak of the Ebola virus in Guinea. A new report says the Ethiopian government is using some of the world's most advanced surveillance software to monitor communications from Ethiopians at home and abroad. And wheat farmers in Ethiopia are on alert for a dangerous outbreak of stem rust. Coming up, music from Ghana and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Sporty greetings, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand we'll soon be hearing a friendly voice from South Africa.
Kim, joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sunny, and good evening to all our listeners around Africa.
David, two of Africa's greatest footballers, Samuel Eto'o of Cameroon and Yaya Toure of Ivory Coast, who will both play at June's World Cup in Brazil. Big performances over the weekend in the English Premier League. VOA! Tell our VOA listeners about that.
Sunny, it's absolutely amazing. I think on your show about a month ago, we bemoaned the fact that Africans, they were firing blanks around Europe. They just weren't scoring goals. They must have all listened to the sunny side of sport because there's been a deluge since, Sunny. And as you said, among them, Yaya Toure and Samuel Eto'o. Let's look at Toure first. He scored a hat-trick against Fulham in a 5-0 victory for Manchester City. And that is his first career hat-trick. So big, big high-five to Yaya Toure.
This time, I think I was very lucky and very happy as well for the team, you know, because I always not involved in this situation, kind of situation like today, you know, score 3 goals. And I think I'm delighted. And I think on the hand, we won brilliantly. And I think I have to thank all the players because we play very well today.
I'm actually, Sunny, after this program, about to do a short story on Yaya Toure. And I was just thinking that, you know, he's been a colossus. But what he's really added to his armory this season in England is goals, goals, and more goals. It seems just about every week when we discuss goal scorers in Europe, the name Yaya Toure crops up. And he went one better than before against Fulham. The first two goals were penalties. He converted both with aplomb. And then a beautiful curling strike, very reminiscent of the one he scored against Sunderland in the English League Cup final. So a bad day at the office for Fulham, but a great day for Yaya Toure. And also a great day for Africans when Chelsea demolished Arsenal 6-0 in the London derby. Samuel Eto'o, ever since Jose Mourinho cast doubts over his age, officially Eto'o is 33, but Mourinho thought maybe he's just a little bit older. Eto'o has been answering those remarks in the best way possible. He's been scoring lots of goals. We didn't have any demonstration of old age this week, but we did have a very fine goal against Arsenal. And we also had a first goal from Mohamed Salah. He's the Egyptian who joined Chelsea from the Swiss club Bâle, and his goal completed that 6-0 demolition. That was, incidentally, the 1,000th game in charge for the Arsenal manager, Arsene Wenger.
We were not at the level today. And after 20 minutes, it was game over. And that becomes a nightmare then. You know, you have no chance to come back, basically.
Not a match for him to remember. There were other goals in the English Premier League from Africans. Papa Cisse of Newcastle, he was recalled to the Magpies team, and he scored a stoppage-time winner at home against Crystal Palace. Also on target was the Nigerian Peter Omdemwingi. He scored one of the 4 goals for Stoke City in a 4-1 victory at Aston Villa. A really good win that for Stoke. Stoke have always been a stubborn team at home, but they've struggled on the road. And basically that result assures them of Premier League football status next season. If we then move to the La Liga in Spain, we were praising Youssef El Arabi, the Moroccan who plays for Granada, on your show last week, Sonny. And this week he turned provider. He set up a goal for the Algerian Yassine Brahimi, and that was a goal that brought a 1-0 victory over fellow strugglers Elche. Switching to Italy, and Giovino, the Ivorian midfielder who plays for AS Roma, he was on target in a 2-0 victory for his side at Chievo, and that kept Roma in second position. We then switched to France, and there were goals for Serge Gakpé, the Togolese who plays for Nantes. For Abdul Majid Waris, the Ghanaian, he scored 2 goals, but sadly not enough for Valenciennes. They went down 3-2 to Ajaccio. And there was also a goal for Manour Abadi of Monaco in a 1-1 draw. He scored for presently the second-place team in the French League One. And then, Sonny, really broadening our net, we go very east in Europe, right over to Russia. And there are a couple of goals. A Nigerian midfielder, Ogude, scored for Amkar Perm. And also the Senegalese Dame Ndoye scored for Lokomotiv Moscow. So all we can say to all those Africans around Europe is keep it up. Ever since we criticized you, the goals have come in leaps and bounds. So well done to all our African scorers across the continent of Europe.
David, as you look at Europe, two leagues in particular, La Liga in Spain and the English Premiership, certainly some very hotly contested races right now. How about an update?
Yes, Sonny. Well, the El Clasico had everything. That's, of course, the match between Barcelona and Real Madrid. This time, Real Madrid were at home, but Barcelona emerged 4-3 victors. And that was a result I was happy with, not because I support one team over the other, but it just makes the run-up to the final matches in La Liga all that more exciting. The current position, Sonny, is that Atletico Madrid are on top. They've got 70 points. Real Madrid have also got 70 points, and Barcelona have got 69. Now, a lot of people who might have looked at the Spanish La Liga table will have been surprised to see Atletico on top because Real Madrid have got a better goal difference. But the reason Atletico are on top is that in Spain, head-to-head comes first. That comes ahead of goal difference. So, in other words, it's the direct results between the two clubs, and Atletico have got the edge over Real. And that's why they're in front. But a really exciting climax. You know, down the years, Sonny, it's either been Barcelona running away with the title or Real Madrid running away with the title. But this year, we have not a two-horse, but three-horse race. And that's really going to create a fantastic finish. The match itself, of course, was there were so many talking points. There was the Lionel Messi hat-trick, Cristiano Ronaldo scoring. We had 2 goals from Benzema. And then we also had the sending off of Sergio Ramos. Every time I watch Real Madrid, Ramos gets either a yellow card or a red card. He's just a serial offender. And unfortunately, it cost Real dearly because they were leading 3-2 when he went, and they ended up with that 4-3 defeat. Now, in England, it's no less exciting, although the league table is slightly difficult to read at the moment because you have Chelsea with 69 points, but they've played 31 matches. Liverpool have got 65 points from 30 games. So theoretically, I stress in theory, Liverpool could move within 1 point of Chelsea if they win their games in hand. And Manchester City, they're 6 points behind Chelsea, but they do have 3 games in hand. So if they win all those games, again, in theory, they would be 3 points ahead. Arsenal, Sonny, I don't think they can make it any longer. They're 7 points behind Chelsea. They do have 1 game in hand, but they've taken some real hidings of late. The most recent, of course, that 6-0 drubbing from Chelsea. So I'm going to stick my neck out and say, I think with a fair degree of certainty, that it's now a three-horse race. Chelsea, Liverpool and Manchester City. And if you push me, I'd probably say it's really between Chelsea and Manchester City. In the other leagues, Sonny, the big ones in Europe, it looks like the outcomes are foregone conclusions. Bayern Munich are winning the German Bundesliga at a canter. Juventus are doing likewise with the Italian Serie A. And in France, the big spenders, Paris Saint-Germain, they're going to walk away with the title, with Monaco well behind in second place.
Thanks, David. That's our football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. In a National Basketball Association game between two clubs going in very different directions, the San Antonio Spurs spanked the visiting Philadelphia 76ers 113-91. It was the 14th victory in a row for the Spurs, who have the NBA's best record at 54 wins and 16 losses. Meanwhile, it was the 25th loss in a row for the 76ers. You heard right, VOA basketball fans. 25 losses in a row. The 76ers are now only one loss away from tying the NBA record for most consecutive losses. The Cleveland Cavaliers lost 26 games in a row during the 2010-2011 NBA season. And while Tim Duncan played against Philadelphia, scoring 19 points, the Spurs rested three other starters, Tony Parker, Tiago Splitter, and Danny Green. But they didn't need them against the lowly 76ers, who have 15 victories and 56 defeats. And while Philadelphia has lost 25 games in a row, the club still doesn't have the worst record in the NBA. That dubious distinction belongs to the Milwaukee Bucks, who are at the bottom of the table with 13 wins and 58 losses. Now let's go to Miami, Florida, the home of the two-time defending NBA champion Miami Heat. The Heat edged the visiting Portland Trailblazers Monday night, 93-91. Superstar LeBron James scored 32 points, including a layup with about 11 seconds left in the game. Now, there's been talk that LeBron might invest in a new Major League Soccer franchise based in Miami, and which would be owned by English star David Beckham. A quick update now. Beckham's architects and advisors have recommended the Port of Miami as the stadium site for the MLS expansion club. The announced plan would have an open-air stadium with views of the bay and the downtown skyline. The seating capacity could be as low as 21,000 or as high as 35,000. Beckham wanting an MLS franchise in Miami. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, a new study shows community-based care is an effective strategy for treating individuals with schizophrenia. And Nigeria's leaders attended a national conference to focus on the country's future ahead of a presidential election in 2015. First, let's listen to a little music. Here's Rita Adomoga of Agana with Make Somebody Smile.
For you and me, so let's just show somebody love so we can live in unity to the whole wide world so we all can be free. Come on, keep a smile.
Every day is a blessing. We must love one another. For our Father is love. Let's give him all the glory. All this care for his people. Give some reason to smile. Make somebody feel love. Let's give them that gentle smile.
Rita Adamoga, make somebody smile. Well, experts say less than 10% of people with mental illness in low-income countries receive treatment. A new study shows community-based care is an effective strategy for treating individuals with schizophrenia. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Researchers found the most successful way to treat people with mental illness in resource-poor countries is for the care to come to them. In the first rigorous trial of community-based care for the mentally ill, researchers looked at the benefits of home visits at three sites in India, comparing the outcomes to those who received their care exclusively from mental health clinics. The study involves schizophrenic patients ages 16 to 60. A professor of community psychiatry at the Institute of Psychiatry at King's College London, Graham Thornycroft, led the study.
So what we wanted to do in this study is to find out, can we develop a relatively simple and affordable type of treatment that will increase the number of people who get treatment and increase the quality of care?
Thornycroft says trained healthcare workers visited the homes of 187 schizophrenic patients, making sure they took their antipsychotic medicine regularly and educating family members on how to care for loved ones with mental illness. The patients also visited mental health clinics for professional care. Their progress was compared to that of 95 patients who received their care exclusively at mental health facilities. A year later, Thornycroft says, researchers noted a significant improvement among patients who'd been visited regularly by healthcare workers.
For example, voices or delusions were less in the community treatment option. Secondly, the levels of disability were lower when people had community care as well as the medical treatment. And third, people were more often likely to take their medication if they had the close support of coming to visit their homes rather than getting no follow-up between the doctor's visits.
In a study published in the journal The Lancet, researchers noted community intervention was more expensive than clinical care alone. But Thornycroft says this has to be weighed against the enormous social costs of not treating individuals with schizophrenia and other debilitating mental conditions. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Nigeria's leaders attended a national conference to focus on the country's future and to tackle major challenges facing Africa's largest economic power, the Islamic insurgency, government corruption, and distribution of resources. The national conference comes ahead of a presidential election in 2015. Sylvester Okere, the chairman of Maryland Nigeria State Executive Committee, told reporter Vincent McCorry that he does not think the conference is a waste of time.
I don't think it's a waste of time. It's a starting point.
to healing. We have to come to a town hall. We have to discuss and understand each other's opinion and know the direction we are going. I think it's good.
Now, some are looking at the representation and saying, okay, 500, how many people? 500 people representing 150 or so million people that reside in Nigeria. How realistic is that?
Well, we do not need the entire state or nation to represent there. All we need is a proper platform, framework. Like, I think we had this debate some time ago, October, when it was at the inception. And I did indicate that we need the proper framework. The youths need to be fully represented, because talking about future, we're talking about where to go.
And that is what is the main concern of the youth.
Thank you.
Just seen at least a representation that they're saying it's a bunch of old men, politicians, they're no youths.
And they are right, because they're a bunch of old people. Women, though I'm glad I saw a few women there, but the youths and the women are the most neglected segment of our community, Africa in general. And for us to talk about future, we need to have the youths involved, and we need to have all religious leaders.
So
all traditional
has this
leaders.
Conference started on the wrong footing by having wrong representation
I don't think it's wrong footing, but let's begin, and I believe an amendment could be made. I think the president, when this... as they progress, they should be bringing more people in.
Many Nigerians don't trust politicians because they say they are behind all the problems of Nigeria, behind corruption, mismanagement, and they're the same fellows sitting around a table. How can you expect any positive results from a conference like this when there's so many interests in that kind of situation, the chaotic situation that exists?
Well, it's everywhere anyway, but I understand where you're coming from. People do not trust politicians because the problem we have, we do not have ethical leaders. Many of them, frankly, just there to make the money and show the power. Nigeria has been having this problem on and on, and this is the time for people to rethink and find out the solution. What are we? Because else we end up being a disappointment to our generation. And we end up being a cost to God because these leaders are asked to go there and represent and serve the people. It's a country of over 170 million population. Yeah. And yet we have great resources, and poverty is, you know, outnumbering the community.
Now, some people are saying, well, the elections are just around the corner. Perhaps it's not the best time because everybody's going to be trying to make this a platform for re-election or election.
No, I don't think so. I believe this is a proper footing, because that can give an inroad to what the election going to be and what the whosoever that is being elected, what to do in the future. Because Nigeria has a lot of problem. And if we don't start now and wait till after the election, I don't know who going to be reelected and what their mindset going to be. I still know some people are against it. Some people don't even want the conference at all. Yeah. But I think it's the right thing to do. Because we need to sit down together and understand each other's opinion. What is the cause of our problem, and how can we solve it? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good point.
And you think it's going to... How long does it last? A month?
I think about 3 months or something like that.
Very.
But the most important thing, let us start from somewhere. And we cannot do this neglecting the youth and the women. We cannot do it neglecting the traditional rulers, because all of them, some of them are like the politicians. Mm-hmm. Even ministers, I mean a Christian or Islamic preacher, some of them are being bought over. And that's a problem we have with our politicians.
That was Sylvester Okere, the chairman of the Maryland Nigeria State Executive Committee. He was speaking to reporter Vincent McCorry. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Bill Barber, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is concerned over the shrinking space for civil society around the world. In a statement to the 25th session of the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, Paula Schrieffer, U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs and Head of Delegation, said that progress depends on the ability of individuals to coalesce around shared goals and harness the power of their convictions. History and current events demonstrate that nations that respect the rights of all their populations are more just, prosperous, and secure. But, Ms. Schrieffer noted, every day journalists and human rights activists report how representatives of civil society are beaten, tortured, and sometimes murdered for expressing opinions and assembling peacefully together. And, she said, restrictions on the rights of freedom of expression and of peaceful assembly and association are instrumental in leading to violence and abuse. Deputy Assistant Secretary Schrieffer cited several areas of concern. In Venezuela, she said, the government is suppressing what began as peaceful demonstrations by students upset with high levels of crime. In efforts to quell the spreading nationwide protests, the government sent troops to use live ammunition against the people, shut down foreign media, the internet and social media, and arrested an opposition political leader and protesters without due process. Ms. Schrieffer said these actions contradict the government's commitment to respect the rights of freedom of assembly and expression. She urged that trusted third parties facilitate the conversation as Venezuelans search for solutions to end the violence and deal with political division in a democratic fashion. In other parts of the world, restrictive laws are hindering civil society's ability to operate. Ms. Schrieffer pointed to Egypt, where the law limits organizations' operations and their ability to receive foreign funding, to Uzbekistan, where a December decree, supposedly aimed at simplifying registration procedures, resulted in NGOs becoming subject to onerous tax inspections and extensive requirements for governmental approval, to Nigeria, where a recent law criminalizes attending or organizing meetings related to LGBT persons. In addition, many countries, Ms. Schrieffer noted, are enacting restrictive internet regulations and have increased detentions and lengthy prison terms for bloggers. This is a critical moment, Deputy Assistant Secretary Schrieffer said to the Council, for member states to redouble our efforts to stand with civil society in the promotion and protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms and the pursuit of democratic progress.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.